Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer of Northwestern University. The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it. We gratefully acknowledge contributions to sustain the Infrastructure Show from Dr. Robert Peskin, Dr. Raymond Ellis, and Andrea and Ron DeFeo. Railroads have been an essential part of the United States economy for at least 170 years. We've all heard about the major national railroads, but there are hundreds of short line and regional railroads across the nation providing services that are locally and sometimes nationally vital. To give us some insights into the extent and the function of these smaller railroads, we're talking today with Henry Posner III, who is the chairman of the Iowa Interstate Railroad and of the Rail Development Corporation, which is a holding company with ownership and operating interest in the rail industry in the United States, the Americas, and Europe. Henry, I'm really delighted to talk to you today.
It's my honor. I love talking about our industry.
Well, you're the right person to be in this conversation. Can you start us out with an easy question for you? What are the short line and regional railroads, and how are they different from what we know as the big railroads, the Class 1 railroads?
Well, the easiest way to define it, I think, is as the last mile. Typically, a short line or regional railroad is the part of a rail haul that either originates or terminates the traffic. And for non-railroad people, that would be kind of like a commuter airline. The commuter airlines, to a certain extent, feed the big airlines, so it's all part of a network.
So why don't the big carriers serve that last mile?
For a number of reasons, one of which is economics, and the other is management. A big company is less able to focus on local markets, so that's one argument. The other is that as local operations, there are a lot of things that smaller companies can do economically in a different way than big companies can.
So that brings up a question that we need to get an answer to, and how are the economics of the short lines and the regionals different from the larger railroads?
Well, it used to be radically different in that in the early days of the short line industry, there were very favorable labor agreements that a startup company could get, especially if a railroad line was abandoned. But as the network has stabilized and as the Class 1s have become more efficient, that cost differential is narrower. And so it's not really fair to say that in every case, a short line is economically more efficient than a, for example, a Class 1. And part of that is the cost and complications of interchange. If a Class 1 can go all the way to the customer for a cost which is within striking range of that a short line can do it, why deal with a short line or why create a short line when you can do it yourself? And I think that explains that the number of short lines has remained more or less flat because the Class 1s have either gotten rid of all of their marginal lines or found ways to operate their own marginal lines themselves.
So what's the difference, or is there a difference, between what you call a short line and a regional railroad?
It's a revenue threshold. Above a certain level of annual revenue is the difference between being a short line, a Class 3 railroad, and a regional railroad, a Class 2 railroad.
And the classes are defined by the regulatory process?
They're defined by annual revenue, and the threshold is set by the Surface Transportation Board. But in general, you can look at a railroad and sort of kind of decide whether it's a short line or a regional, and you definitely know what a Class 1 is. That's a big New York Stock Exchange or Warren Buffett-owned railroad.
And is there a difference in the typical length of a short line in contrast to a regional?
To a certain extent, because a longer line typically has more revenue. But there are some very light density, relatively long short lines out there. And that's why, in order to just make it simple, the threshold is revenue as opposed to miles.
Mm. About how many short lines and regionals are out there?
Roughly 600.
So that's extraordinary. I mean, it's a kind of service that apparently stretches across, covers the nation, but is relatively unknown.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, you know, the rail industry is relatively unknown. I think we're a stealth industry in part because people do not relate to railroads because of the minimal levels of passenger service that you'll find. But if you scratch a couple layers behind the surface of most any sort of economic activity in this country, railroads play at least a minor part, and in many cases a big part.
So what was their origin? They didn't start out as short lines, did they?
Well, actually, they did. The original railroads were feeders to the national transportation grid at the time, which was the rivers and the oceans. So if you look at a railroad map of, for example, 1850, which is something I teach an undergrad class at Carnegie Mellon, and it's one of the exhibits I use. If you look at the map of railroads in 1850, and you didn't know that there were rivers, you'd think there were a bunch of squiggly lines all randomly tossed around the country. And then you superimpose where the rivers went, and that explains everything.
So they were feeding river traffic?
They were feeding rivers and oceans.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, if you look at a map of Latin America and Africa, the map today looks more or less the same. Railroads go to the nearest ocean, or in some cases, the nearest river.
I would assume that the reason for that is that water transportation is very efficient. At least it's very low cost when nature provides the water.
Correct. When nature provides the water, as long as you haven't got a drought or a flood, it works pretty well.
Yeah. So tell us about the function of these railroads, and maybe you want to do that in the context of Iowa Interstate.
Well, the Iowa Interstate's an anomaly in that it is actually a main line running from Chicago to Omaha, where at one point there were 7 main lines from Chicago to Omaha. And at one point it was down to 3 when, after the Milwaukee Road liquidated, the Rock Island liquidated, et cetera. But there were a bunch of customers located on the line who wanted to be connected to the national rail grid, and so they bought the railroad in order to keep it open, or should I say to reopen it. And so we're not typical in that we are more or less a former main line as opposed to a branch line, and we're paralleled by other railroads. But the reason we exist is because there are customers on the railroad for whom trucking to the nearest other railroad would have been too expensive. And the classic example at the time the Iowa Interstate was formed in 1884 was Maytag, the washing machine company. And their main manufacturing facility was in the center of what's now the Iowa Interstate in Newton, Iowa. And so they would get inbound steel into their factory by rail, and they would ship the outbound product in intermodal containers. They were representative of the customers that are now along the Iowa Interstate. We have steel mini mill, number of grain customers, grain processors, ethanol plants, a fairly diverse traffic base. But in every case, we are their rail connection to the national rail grid.
And do those same customers still own the Iowa Interstate?
No. The original Iowa Interstate shareholder group is basically a shotgun marriage of a bunch of industrial companies that had a single goal, which was to restore rail service so they would have competition against trucks. That objective was satisfied the day after the railroad reopened. So with the passage of time, the ownership has been restructured and restructured and restructured, and now it's a pure standalone railroad, and the customers have competition, so they're happy. Or should I say the customers that are still in business, of which there are not many of the original shareholder group.
Has the railroad been able to attract new customers since then?
Yes. We like to think of ourselves as a linear industrial park running from Council Bluffs, Iowa to Western Illinois. And in many cases, we have customers who've located on our railroad precisely because they want rail service and precisely because they want to be on an independent company that will link them to the national rail network.
And when you say they've located on the railroad, then that to me means they have a siding or a set-aside track that they can park their own cars or somebody else's rail cars on?
Precisely. Yeah, like, for example, if you are a company that manufactures things that come in plastic bottles, quite often the plastic resin pellets move in covered hopper cars 100 tons at a time. And what you want to have is a rail siding so that that covered hopper can sit right outside and you deliver the product directly from the hopper car into the plant.
And the hopper car, as you're describing it, it sounds like it's effectively temporary storage for the manufacturer.
In some cases. You know, storage is a bad word because you don't want to have stuff tied up in inventory. Because of the logistics cost, transportation, handling, carrying cost of inventory, et cetera, all those factors work together to determine what happens in freight transportation. And in some cases, there is a competitive advantage to doing it exactly that way. Because the alternative to shipping 100 tons of plastic pellets in a single covered hopper is to ship it in three trucks.
Three trucks and three truck drivers.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And yeah, there are the environmental benefits, but sadly, I have yet to meet a customer who was willing to pay extra for an environmental benefit.
But they're glad to pay less to get the service from the railroads.
Right.
Is Iowa Interstate different in terms of its customer base and its functionality from other regionals?
Yeah, each one is different, and each one has a different traffic base. Each one goes through a different geographic territory. We don't go across the Rockies, so we're not particularly scenic, but we do have a lot of history.
And what's the scale of the rolling stock? Does Iowa Interstate own a lot of cars, or are they owned by others?
For the most part, the cars are owned by other railroads or customers. And the reason for that is just the traffic mix. Typically, if you are a customer that originates traffic, then that determines who either owns or leases the cars. But in our case, most of our customers are covered hopper and tank car customers. And all tank cars are owned by customers or leasing companies. Railroads don't own tank cars because of contamination problems. And for example, you don't want to reload a tank car with wine after you've just hauled a load of pesticide. But in the covered hopper market, there are railroad-owned cars, but customers own a lot of them too. The price reflects car costs, and in many cases, customers find it more efficient to own or lease their own cars as opposed to using railroad-owned cars.
Yeah. And then they would be captive. It's easier for them to get the car when they need it, and there's no issue of contamination.
For the most part, there are free-running cars, like boxcars, where what you want to do is reload the car as quickly as possible after it's been unloaded because the utilization is very poor. You'd be lucky if you get two or three trips a month out of a boxcar. But other cars are in captive cycling service. Classic example being tank cars due to the contamination and other issues.
And the power, the locomotives, Iowa Interstate owns them?
Yes.
And do you do your own maintenance?
Yes. We have a purpose-built maintenance facility, which we built in South Amana, Iowa. It was our biggest investment ever, $25 million, specifically for our GE locomotive fleet. So we have made significant investments in new locomotives, which we bought from GE starting in 2008. And we were very proud to be GE's smallest customer when we started buying the locomotives. But we justified them based on fuel savings and the additional capacity that the locomotives represented.
Okay, so my understanding is that some of the short lines don't own their own power, but they lease it.
It is all over the map in terms of ownership. And it really is, for the most part, a financial decision. Many railroads lease locomotives. We don't. Many railroads do. And in fact, the big railroads, may do sale leasebacks with leasing companies, depending on the financial deal. So it's very diverse.
So from a financial perspective, is this a viable industry? I mean, the scale of it is such that it would suggest to me that, yeah, people must be doing well because they keep going.
Well, the Class 1 railroads are on the New York Stock Exchange, except for BNSF, which is owned by Warren Buffett. And it's, in general, it's a good time to be a railroad.
But is that also true for the smaller railroads, for the short lines?
Yes. Of the 600 railroad companies in the USA, which are mostly short lines, 99% or maybe 98% are owned by private sector companies.
I mean, it's just so interesting that the scale of this is so large. So my presumption is if a shipper that's served by the Iowa Interstate ships something to the Middle West, the revenue for that move is shared by every railroad that touches it.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting subject. Railroad pricing is surprisingly interesting. And in fact, for my students, it's the most interesting thing year after year. And one would think that would be one of these really boring subjects. But pricing is quite an interesting subject. And I think in part it's because by the time you become a college student, you've already bought transportation in a deregulated market where the prices are always changing. So if you bought an airline ticket, you probably looked at which flight do I book, which day of the week, how far in advance, and all that, because it's always changing. And thanks to deregulation, it is to a certain extent like that in the rail industry, but in a different way. And what makes it interesting in a different way in the rail industry is that you've got to have every railroad in the hall agreeing to a level of revenue for themselves that, if you combine it, is still cheaper than the competition, which is usually truck, and yet makes a profit for you so that you get to stay in business.
So that's pretty complicated. Are those arrangements negotiated kind of long-term, or is it on a shipment-by-shipment basis?
They're, for the most part, negotiated medium-term, meaning that there are general guidelines and there are default prices, but people are constantly tinkering with them. And that again, that's what makes pricing so interesting.
And presumably, to stay in business, a short line railroad, just like the larger railroads, needs to earn its cost of capital and maintain the physical plant with that money.
Correct. Yeah, the railroad industry is definitely a long-term business, which is subject to short-term events. So it's a very interesting business from a management perspective because, on the one hand, you're making investments that are like a locomotive is a 30-year investment, and a track might be a 50- or 100-year investment. And yet, you don't know from year to year what your markets are going to be or what the next natural disaster is going to be. Or, you know, sometimes there are self-inflicted things, like from a regulatory perspective. So there's all kinds of stuff that can happen. And that's why it's such an interesting business, at least to people like me.
And the future, how does the future look to you right now?
It looks good. I think that the industry is pretty good at tempering expectations with reality. And I think the idea of spectacular growth, where people are going to flock back to shipping by rail because of the environmental benefits and all the endangered species are going to come back as a result, and it will always be sunny and the air will always be breathable, is probably a stretch. We are part of the solution, but we're only as good as how well our customers do. And so our main task is to keep focus on what the markets are going forward and making sure that we are best positioned to serve those markets and do our part to keep those industries in business, or in the case of new industries, to help promote them.
That says to me the marketing arm of the railroad is really critical to its success and survival.
Well, as a former marketing person, I would argue that they are the most important.
That's a good argument. Henry, I really appreciate you spending the time with us. You've certainly educated me about these important parts of the rail industry. I think maybe we'll find a way to put a link on our website so people across the country will know where they might go to actually observe one of these regionals or short line railroads.
Well, all they have to do is go on the web, and there are tens of thousands of train enthusiasts that will smooth the way.
Okay. Well, I'm going to get started on that right away. Thank you very much. I really appreciate your spending the time with us today.
My pleasure. As I'm sure you could tell, I love talking about our industry.
Well, I'll keep you on the list. We'll get back to you. Thank you very much.
Right.
Great. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Infrastructure Show. If you enjoyed the conversation as much as we did, please subscribe to our podcast and encourage your friends to join us too. The Infrastructure Show is recorded at the Studio Media Recording Company in Evanston, Illinois, under the direction of Scott Steinman, recording engineer with a commitment to great sound. Our producer is Marion Sowers, a journalist with a passion for infrastructure. And I am Professor Joseph Schoeffer. Few people are more curious about infrastructure than I am.